It's moving.
Yes. This is an interview with Peter Brindley at his home here at 65 Elm in Mill Valley on November 2nd, 2001. The interviewer is myself, Dale Comey, representing the Mill Valley Historical Society. This is tape one, side one.
Start, Peter, with your early years. You were raised here in Mill Valley, but technically born in San Francisco. Can you kind of describe your growing up time?
I was originally, my parents lived at 148 Elm. They had come here in about 1940, and there were no other hospitals in Marin, as far as I know, other than San Rafael, but at any rate, I was born at Stanford Hospital in San Francisco in 1942, and we stayed in Mill Valley at 148 Elm until about 1944, and we then moved to 61 Scott Street, which is down in Homestead, and in 1947, we moved back to Elm Street at 55, and remained there until 1960. When I was growing up, I attended Homestead School, Old Mill School, Park School, Alto School, and graduated from TAM in 1960.
How many, what was your graduating class size at TAM during that time?
I think at that point it was about 230 to 250.
In middle school and grammar school, how many kids were in your class at any time, 40 or 50 or larger than that?
Well, the class sizes were probably somewhere in the vicinity of 30. The overall class, a grade, was probably somewhere in the vicinity of about 120. I was ahead of the baby boom, and shortly after I graduated from Alto, they built a new school at McGuire next door to handle the larger number of kids.
When did your father come here to the Bay Area, and what was his circumstances?
My dad originally, he was born in England, immigrated to Canada about 1910. He got his schooling in British Columbia, where he was an outstanding soccer player, or rugby player. And about 1925-26, immigrated to Los Angeles, and stayed down there until 1937, I believe, maybe 38, when he came to San Francisco. He was in advertising and public relations, and worked for one firm for 41 years from 1928 to about 1969-1970. Worked in San Francisco, commuted every day.
How far back did your mother go as far, just her side of the family? Been in the Bay Area for a long time?
No, they immigrated to Los Angeles from Denver in the early 30s. My parents met in Los Angeles. My father was a widower, and he had a young son at that point named Gordon. And they met and married in 1938. And subsequently moved to San Francisco, where my dad was transferred.
And describe sort of your growing up years. You've lived in Mill Valley virtually all your life. What was your day-to-day kind of activities, both during school and after school, in this grammar school?
Well, living next to Boyle Park was very, very fortunate. And because of that, everything basically revolved around sports activities. We seemed to always have 20 to 30 kids down at Boyle Park, had pickup baseball games, football games, sometimes just rode our bikes, spent a lot of time in the creeks. We were called creek rats, and just basically in those days just had a great time. It was idyllic, really. There were none of the pressures that the kids seem to have today, and so we just basically had fun. We had a group of us used to do a lot of camping up on North Ridge behind my house, and we built forts and tree houses. One guy had a tree house that had about 800 square feet in an oak tree, and we spent a lot of time in that, and just had a great time. Played golf, played tennis, swam at the tennis club. Basically no worries. It was cool.
Now, you were born in or raised in 148 Elm. I assume that house is still there today?
Yes.
And does it look pretty much the same as when you were growing up?
Well, when we moved out of there, I was about two, maybe two and a half. Interestingly enough, though, I always had in my mind the floor plan of that house. And a number of years ago, I went in, and it was exactly as I remembered it, which was really quite interesting. But we stayed there, and then we moved to Scott Street, and we moved out of Scott Street when I was about six, and moved up to 55 Elm. And that's where I spent most of my younger years, next to Boyle Park, which, interestingly enough, is right next door to where I'm living now.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your any mentors or teachers that you looked up to during school, either the middle school or high school.
Well, actually, there were two that really stand out in my mind. One was in elementary, they were both in elementary school. One was a lady named Betty Grimm, who originally was the principal at Homestead, and who I stayed in contact until her, she was killed in an accident about 1970, I think. But we stayed in contact, and she really provided me a lot of guidance, and she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And my fifth grade teacher was a fellow named Dante Castelli, and he also, being the first male role model outside of my father that I really was associated with, had a great impact on our life. He was as I recall, a veteran of World War II, and was very strong in teaching us social responsibility, how we were supposed to act, held us to a very high level of discipline within the school, the classroom, and then we would go out at lunchtime or recess, and he would be right in it with us, and he was really quite a remarkable man. I am very fond of him. He too has passed on, as far as I know, but he really had a dramatic impact on us.
You mentioned that sports was a big part of your life growing up. What did you think of the local baseball teams and stuff? What did you do? Did you go to any of their games as a kid?
We did. During the years we were growing up, Mill Valley had a semi-pro team called the Mill Valley Merchants, or the Mill Valley VFW, and they played at Boyle Park every Sunday. And in those days, there was a large grandstand, and all the fellows that had come back from World War II would play in a league that involved like Tiburon, San Rafael, Richmond, San Francisco, and these games would be very highly attended. There were probably 500-600 people at every game. People would park their cars up along Buena Vista, right in center field. One guy I remember was a fellow named Fred Barrick, had a red Cadillac or Oldsmobile, convertible, and he'd sit up there and always seem to be surrounded by women, and he'd be dead center field, and the guys would try to aim for the car a lot of times. And I was the bat boy for them for about 4 years, and being around those fellas was very educational too. And in terms of you know, the larger arena, we used to go to the San Francisco Seals games, 49er games, Oakland Oaks games, and really enjoyed that. And I was very, very disappointed when the Dodgers didn't come to San Francisco. And although I love the Giants now, I actually cried. The Brooklyn Dodgers were my heroes. I was very, very disappointed that we didn't get them. But I love the Giants.
Did you get a chance to meet any famous ball players while growing up as a kid? Or see them in action?
Well, actually, one of my biggest thrills was watching Ted Williams. The Seals were a farm team for the Boston Red Sox, and Ted Williams came out and played an exhibition game, and so I was able to watch him. And then there was one fellow that I really liked. His name was Mike Baxes, and he played for the Seals and ultimately went up into the majors with the Kansas City team, I believe. Yeah, Kansas City A's. And before they moved to Oakland. And interestingly enough, his wife, when I joined the police department, worked for us, and so I got to know him. So he gave me his baseball card, which was really neat, and which I still have. And so we became friends. So one of those unusual circumstances where one of your heroes, you get to know him personally. But other than that, no, not really, not when I was a kid.
How did you get around town and around the Bay Area as a kid? Did you take the local bus, or did you walk, or what was the
transportation? We walked and rode our bicycles 99% of the time, and there was no public transportation as is the case now, and so anywhere that we wanted to go, we had to get there on our own. When I was going to Alto School, which was the middle school, in the seventh grade, they had a bus service that we got at Park School and rode over to Alto. And then in the eighth grade, to be cool, we all rode our bikes down there. And I rode my bike to TAM until my junior year when I got a car. And that's how we all got around.
What were some of the recreational spots that you used to hang out as, just say, during high school or middle school?
Well, the recreational spots were varied. Of course, Boyle Park. We spent a lot of time at Boyle Park. And then on Saturdays, all the kids would go to the Saturday matinee, where you get a double feature, a cereal, and five cartoons for 7 cents. And then we come out and emulate who we saw on the screen, whether it be Roy Rogers or John Wayne or whoever. And then as we got older, we would go on Sunday nights to the theater. And the theater seemed to be kind of the gathering spot for the younger teenagers. That's where you went to meet your girlfriend and sit in the loges and neck and all that kind of stuff. And, it was really a neat place to be in Mill Valley in those days. They had a number of small restaurants, coffee shops. There was a place called Stuyvesant's on the square, where the Bank of California is today. La Ginestra was called Espasti's. We used to spend a lot of time in there, and then later there was a small drive-in called C's, which is half a block up from Tam High, where Kentucky Fried Chicken is now in the 500 block of Miller. And hung out there a lot. And we used to have a lot of dances. They had dances at a place called Brown's Hall, which is now the Buddhist temple right near the intersection of Miller and Montford. And every Friday and Saturday night we'd have dances there. And then we would go to various places around the county. Fairfax had a women's club that we used to go to dances up there. San Rafael had a couple places that we went to. And then as an older teenager, those of us that were into hot rods and cars spent a lot of time in drive-ins. There was the C's in Mill Valley. There was the Circle, which was in Corte Madera, where the Cadillac dealership is now. There was the King Cotton, which is down in the canal area of San Rafael. There was one in uptown San Rafael that I think was called King James something. And there were several in San Rafael. And so we kind of make the circuit, drive around, and, you know, the typical 50s deal. And just had a great time. Not without conflict sometimes, but had a good time.
What kind of car did you drive in second high school?
I had a 55 Chevy convertible, and which was very fast. So we used to do a lot of drag racing. A lot of times we'd go out towards San Quentin. They had just put the highway into the Richmond Bridge, and it had virtually no traffic. And we'd go out there a lot of times and race, and then we'd go down to the Great Highway in San Francisco. And there were literally hundreds of cars down there. Some would race. It was just basically a hangout place. And so we had a lot of fun down there. And they had a place near there called Playland at the Beach. We spent a lot of time there. And like I said, it was no worries. It was a lot of fun.
Now, back in the early 70s, George Lucas did his American Graffiti movie, which was, I think, based out of Petaluma. Did you find sort of his representation of life in the late 50s, 60s parallel to what you experienced?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Matter of fact, it was interesting. That was actually filmed in downtown San Rafael. And it was based, as far as I know, on his growing up in Modesto. And but it was all the same throughout California anyway. Interestingly enough, when they were putting that together, George and his wife lived in Mill Valley. And she contacted me. I was on the police department. And she contacted me because somebody had told her that I might know where she could find some of these cars. And so I gave her some names, and I think she used a few of them in the film. But yeah, that was a fairly good representation of what it was like cruising. And it was later called cruising. We didn't call it cruising, but San Rafael was really the focal point for most of Marin County kids. And they would go up and down Forest Street, literally hour on end. You just go back and forth, back and forth. And that's what that movie depicted. From that standpoint, it was very accurate.
Now, your father was in advertising all his life. How did he feel about your wanting to get into law enforcement?
He was not happy about it. He had seen a Los Angeles police officer killed in front of him, I guess sometime in the 30s. And as I recall, the story was is, he was sitting in an intersection in his car and saw the officer fighting with somebody in the intersection. And in those days, many of the police officers carried what they called cross draws, which meant that the handle of the gun was pointing outward from the body. And during the course of this fight, the officer's gun was pulled out by the by the bad guy, and he shot the officer in the chest and killed him. And so at that point, you know, my dad thought that law enforcement was a very dangerous occupation.
What maybe turned him around on that over the years? Was he able to see why you went into that line of work?
Well, he was very supportive of it. The reason I got into it primarily was, you know, I wasn't able to serve in the military because of an ankle problem. And I felt like this was one way that I could really contribute. Plus, I found it absolutely fascinating on two levels. One was you had to really have your wits about you to deal effectively with the public. And when I first started, you frequently had to deal with situations on your own because the department wasn't large enough to always have a backup officer. We didn't have portable radios, and so when you got out of the car, you were essentially on your own. And you had to be an effective communicator in order to resolve a lot of the problems. And so I found that part of it fascinating. I was generally successful. The other part of it was is that I came in right after the Miranda decision had been enacted by the Supreme Court. And because of that, subsequent court rulings from all over California, either at the Superior Court level within your county or the appellate court decisions and then ultimately the California Supreme Court decisions, made everything very much in flux in terms of law. And I found that the task of trying to keep up with that was absolutely fascinating. And it still does. Trying to understand the nuances of what the courts are saying, and then how do you apply that so that you don't get a case thrown out. And as a patrolman and later as a supervisor, you know, it's crucial that if you're going to be doing the job, you have to do it properly. And so you had to keep up. There were points when it was day-to-day where a decision would come out one day, and it would tell you to do it this way, and the next day you'd get another notification that another court had ruled, and so you had to do it exactly opposite. So it was very much in flux, but it was absolutely fascinating to me. And so from that standpoint, you know, my dad understood that, and he was supportive. It's interesting that my son is now a police officer, and he's on the SWAT team in Sacramento, and he's been an officer there for 7 years. And I know now what my dad was thinking. Even though I was involved in it, and I have absolute confidence in him and his department and the tactics and everything, there's always something there that you're always concerned for their safety, particularly in his position, because they're used so much in high-risk situations. And so I don't think my dad ever lost his concern for our safety. But he was outwardly supportive of it.
Now, you started on the police force in, I believe, 1966. Tell us about the political and social climate of the San Francisco and Marin County area during that particular time and how that affected your work.
Well, when I started, the Flower Children had not yet arrived. It was about another year before the Summer of Love, I believe it was called. And when that started happening, we started seeing a lot of these kids that had come from all over the country kind of overflow into Mill Valley and all of Marin County. Sausalito, Mill Valley, and Fairfax seemed to have gotten the brunt of it. And initially, it wasn't a very difficult situation. It was all new to us because we had so many people coming in, and they'd come on foot or in cars or motorcycles or buses or however they got here, and so we would have an awful lot of contacts with them. A church down on Camino Alto, the Methodist Church, opened up a drop-in center, and that attracted a lot of kids. And then it seemed like very shortly thereafter, what happened to the whole thing, which initially was okay, was drugs. And it started out with marijuana, and then we started seeing a lot of LSD and especially a lot of methamphetamine. And the ones that caused us the most problems were the people that were on speed, and they were injecting it, many of them, and they created a lot of difficulties for the community. With all of these people coming in, and it turned out that after the wave of the first kids had come and gone, that we started attracting basically just a lot of bums. We had a significant number of people from out of state that were ex-cons. Charlie Manson was here, and people like him were very common. And what then started occurring was that we started having a whole lot of overdose cases. We had, and then we started getting the residential burglaries that got up to a point where my first residential burglary that I took in 1966, the chief and the captain responded to the location with red lights and siren. In the early 70s, I was taking 11 a night, 10 or 11 a night. Other officers were taking the same number. We were up over, well over 400, between 400 and 500 for about 5 years. And they were significant burglaries. They just weren't little break-ins. They were, in those days, they were taking primarily electronics. Stereos were new. When the Hunt brothers cornered the silver market, it seemed like every piece of silver in the county disappeared because it was up to about $55 an ounce. Jewelry, of course. So they were significant burglaries, and it had a huge impact on us, on the whole community. It made the alarm system companies. You know, at one point we had in the police department, when we were monitoring alarms, I think we had over 400 residences that came to us, and there were others. So that's how freaked out people were. So it was an ugly time. We had a lot of fights. We had a group that used to hang out down by the bus depot, which is now called the Depot, that would number anywhere between 10 and 50 at any given time. Many of them strung out, some under the influence. In about 1978, I believe it was, Chief Walsh did a analysis of our crime rate, and our city was a city of about 12,000, and we had a crime rate of about 35,000 size city. And so the council basically almost doubled the department. We went from 12 to 24 members in a period of about 18 months. And with that, we were able to stem the tide. And we were able to put people into investigative slots so that we could do more effective follow-ups and so on. And that worked quite well. From a social standpoint, it was very near anarchy. The police were the only real visible points of authority for cities. It wasn't only Mill Valley, it was everywhere. And so they took a lot of heat because of what the federal government was doing in Vietnam and how they were dealing with different issues. And we were put out and to deal with these situations. And as a result of that, the police became quite isolated within their own communities, I think. And as I told you, that there are people that I grew up with in this town that basically wouldn't talk to me. When they saw me in a cop car, they'd flip me the bird, yell obscenities at me. And these are people in their mid-20s that I went all through school with. And it was very disheartening. And it was difficult on the officers. We lost a lot of officers because they just didn't want to deal with it. Very hard on the officers' families. In some cases, the wives were targeted. We had one officer here. They set his house on fire. It was an ugly time. Ugly time. And that lasted pretty much through the end of the war. And for about a year thereafter, it was pretty tough on everybody.
What sort of turned things around and sort of reduced the crime rate and made it a more safer town?
Well, I think a number of things started happening. One, there wasn't the focal point of the war. And people started calming down on that. And a lot of the people that were living in, you know, basically communes in town started getting forced out because of the escalating value of property. And, you know, toward the end of the 70s, property started really moving here and forcing those people out. Unfortunately, I think with that, it kind of changed the tone of the town in some ways, because when I was growing up, this town was very diverse from the standpoint of different what's now called socioeconomical levels, where, you know, the town had working class guys, business executives, they had artists, and with the escalating property values, the working class people have essentially, unless they were fortunate like we were to be in a house, there's no way that they could buy a house. And so they started moving out, and the more affluent people started moving in. And I think in my early days that there was a cohesiveness and a community feeling that was much stronger than it is now. You know, there were a number of service clubs, whether it be the Lions Club or the Rotary, or you know, there was a club called Onapah that my dad belonged to. And when something needed to be done, the people of the community just got together and did it. The two things that stand out in my mind, because I was young and it affected me, I'm sure there were more, but they wanted to start Little League in the middle 50s. And so, you know, a bunch of people got together and they brought in heavy equipment and they graded a spot down by the back of the Marin Theater Company where the condos are now. And the property owner basically let them use it cost, you know, free, and they prepared the site and built a Little League field. There was another thing, our first recreation center here in Mill Valley. Up until this point, there was nothing for kids except what was being done, as I said, the dances and stuff, but nothing really for the younger kids. And a guy named Chuck Mowers owned a restaurant on the frontage road called the Marvel Mar, and he sold it to the children of Mill Valley for $1. And so the fathers got together, and it was the same general group, you know, the Bravos, the Reichmuths, the Woods, all the guys got together. They prepared the site. They moved the building over, and the kids had a recreation center. And long before the city became involved directly with any activities, they would have dances down there and activities and stuff. And that was a pretty neat deal.
When did women start to join the work, the law enforcement force?
About 1980, we had, if not the first, at least the second female in municipal law enforcement. There's several in the sheriff's office that had been there a number of years, but we hired a woman named Linda Flanders, and she was an extraordinary woman. She proved herself. She was a very, very effective communicator, and was able to very, very effectively deal with family disputes, and oftentimes resolve the issues. She stayed with us for 3 to 4 years, and then went to San Francisco, where she just recently retired. Excellent officer.
What kind of things did she and other females bring to the force that have been beneficial?
Oh, I think that female officers put a different perspective on things. They're more apt to try to resolve things through communication. I've always found that at least initially, when at entry level, that they're somewhat better communicators and able to analyze things a bit better than young officers. I think that there's a macho component of new policemen that you have to deal with and train out of, and the women didn't seem to have that. We've had a number of women over the years that have been very good, but that was one trait. I do some consulting now, where I evaluate applicants from all over the country, and I would say that on the whole, that women have at least initially, until you get a lot of training, better communication skills, and it tended to, you know, with a female in a family dispute, for instance, it gave the female victim or female participant in this event somebody to kind of connect to. And rather than just having a house full of male cops, quite often you could almost see the connection, saying, okay, do you understand, or, you know, there's a female perspective, which I think is very beneficial. I think on the whole, the females have done a good job in law enforcement.
When did you become a police chief?
I became police chief in 1987. And replacing Bill Walsh, who had been chief since 1972, I believe. And I retired out in 1997. And I was also the fire chief. It was a position that was created right after the Prop 13, which is a property tax limiting initiative, which reduced the income to the city significantly. And the fire chief retired, and they approached Bill to take on this position. I think initially it was solely to save some money. And Bill did a hugely successful job in terms of being able to work in two different cultures, being the fire and the police departments, and I think was very, very effective in what he did.
In summary, how would you characterize
the changes that have taken place here in Mill Valley in the years that you've grown up till today. Short.
Well, we could be here all day. I think the thing that I see is that when I was growing up, Hillary Clinton wrote a book, said it takes a village to raise a kid, and I agree with her. And when I was growing up, there was a lot more of people knowing each other. You almost knew everybody in town. Where today, I think that, and I know that from my experience on the street as a policeman, that I would go on a burglary call, for instance, and I would say, okay, you know, who are your neighbors? And they say, I don't know, I've never met them. And that kind of stunned me. And I think that there's just not the sense of community that there used to be. I think that people are so caught up in whatever it is they're doing, you know, trying to, by necessity now, people, you know, both parents have to work just to make the mortgage payment and the car payment and all the things and, you know, the college and all the stuff that goes with it. But I think that with that, we've lost something really important, which is a cohesiveness for a community. There's some here, but it certainly doesn't seem to be the same as when I was growing up as a child and seeing the interaction between the adults. The other things in terms of youth, I think that when I grew up, it was basically freewheeling. Of course, it was a different time. There weren't the safety concerns, but we'd go out the door and you'd check in at the noon whistle, which was a horn that went off at City Hall, and you had to be home at 5 when the horn went off. And other than that, it was basically freewheeling. Now, it seems that every kid is programmed. You go to an organized soccer, and then you go to basketball, then you go to baseball, then you go to football, and then you start all over again. And there doesn't seem to be the free time that I found so valuable. I'm a great believer in youth sports. I've coached Little League off and on since 1970. I'm still coaching it. I coached boys and girls soccer. I believe that youth sports activities provide something invaluable to kids that they otherwise wouldn't get, especially in terms of working within a group for a common goal, some discipline, learning how to deal with not winning, because you can't win all the time, and a lot of kids don't understand that. But again, I don't see the fun. It's kind of like I have to go here, I have to go there, and I really think that the kids need to have some free time to be kids, I just don't see that now. So it's still the neatest community I think I could ever live in. I feel very fortunate that I was raised here. I was able to pursue my career here relatively successfully and most importantly raise my kids here. I just wish that my kids could live here, which I don't think they'll be able to.
Peter, thank you very much for your time and insight into life here in Mill Valley.
No, you're welcome.
Thank you.